does not describe a place or an object, nor is it a place or an object, neither adjective or noun, but it is always in motion and operates as an emergent community, stitching together bodies that do not necessarily search for each other. Attentive in her scholarly work to political and economic structures in the soundscape, and persistent in thinking out strategies of listening that diverge from visual signposts, in her compositional work, Salome explores sound events that are temporary, unstable, seemingly small, and as she says, almost fail to happen. The title of Salome's talk tonight is Inaudible Disaster Warning. Please join me in welcoming Salome.
Soldiers were silent, holding their breath. The image of the most beautiful woman lit up inside each of them, so radiant that she would blind him if he could see her. Speaking choruses sprang up, first shy, then enthusiastic. Helen, Helen, they said. Helen did now show herself, did not show herself, nor did she attend the banquet. She was exhausted by the long sea voyage. Paris, the changed man, delivered exquisite gifts given him by his host, the King of Egypt, told miraculous stories. He talked and talked, extravagant, arabesque, with swings which he seemed to consider funny. He laughed many times. He had become a man. I could not take my eyes off him. I could not catch his eyes. Where had his handsome face gotten that crooked line? What sharpness had etched his once soft features? The word plague had just been spoken for the first time. At this point in the story, leaving Bernardrieux at his window, the narrator may be allowed to justify the doctor's uncertainty and surprise, since, with a few slight differences, his reaction was the same as that of most of our townsfolk. Pestilence is in fact very common, but we find it hard to believe in a pestilence when it depends upon us. There have been as many plagues in the world as there have been wars, yet plagues and wars always find people equally unprepared. Dr. Rieu was unprepared, as were the rest of the townspeople, and this is how one should understand his reluctance to believe. One should also understand that he was divided between anxiety and confidence. When war breaks out, people say, it won't last, it's too stupid. And war is certainly too stupid. But that doesn't prevent it from lasting. Stupidity always carries doggedly on, as people would notice if they were not always thinking about themselves. In this respect, the citizens of Oran were like the rest of the world. They thought about themselves. In other words, They were humanists. They did not believe in pestilence. And pestilence doesn't have human dimensions. So people tell themselves that it is unreal, that it is a bad dream which will end. But it does not always end, and from one bad dream to the next, it is people who end. Humanists, first of all, because they have not prepared themselves. The people of our town were no more guilty than anyone else. They merely forgot to be modest and thought that everything was still possible for them, which implied that pestilence was impossible. They continued this business with making arrangements for travel and holding opinions. Why should they have thought about the plague, which negates the future, negates journeys and debates? They considered themselves free, and no one will ever be free as long as there is plague, pestilence, and famine. It is important to remember that the anechoic is not just an environment for eliminating reverberation, a form of sound insulation, noise reduction, or even sensory confinement. It is also the product of excessive sound, of an acoustic environment saturated with competing layers of voice, sonic signals, ambient sound, and noise. In the context of mass media, a common and persistent critique is the presence of an underlying drone that sonically privileges the very loud voices being heard, those broadcast, those financed. However, what is new to the millennium is a dynamic combination that the anechoic represents: sound insulation, media obliteration, and the deracination of sense through the multiplication of the fracture, or separation, between ethics and practice that dulls our ability to fully appreciate the crisis at hand. These are not three separate effects of the anechoic. They interact as a dynamic system. As Michel Serres argues, enclosure from the world contributes to enclosure of the world. Stifling the senses also diminishes the ability to sense, and that is also the ability to make sense of the sensible. The horizon of sound in need of consideration, however, includes sound and all that sound implies, all that it carries both forward and backward, knowledge or an indication of its origin. For instance, a huge sound it made me jump imparts the distance from the listener, the atmosphere that the sound is moving through. I could barely hear it, the rain was so heavy. The clarity of the sound is an indicator of the thickness or thinness of the atmosphere, the amount of humidity, and so on. Also, knowledge of what will happen next. The very first creak of the tree as it begins to fall, we know will be followed by a massive thump, which will be followed by a shaking reverberation. These sounds and this kind of listening contain within them a form of knowledge about the environment, and the mode of sensing the environment determines the process of knowing and the skill of listening itself. Constant attention to only media sonority is a de-skilled process. The monotony that it produces is a form of sonic air conditioning. When I heard the alarm urging us to gather May, I made no effort to stir, to lift my head from the pillow, saying to myself, it's early, I may as well sleep on, when I heard the alarm. Young people share their finds. Unconcern is my friend. I'll share with him forever. He was my neighbor when I heard the alarm. Kindergarten footsteps, Pripyat. The floors and corridors in the kindergarten are covered with 2 decades of debris. Flecked plaster, broken concrete, brick pieces, dry leaves, and in one room, dozens of glass bottles. Every footstep creates a different crunch or snap that reverberates off the bare walls. Those steps, plus wind, are the essential sound of the building. Cuckoo and radiometer. Beside the Ferris wheel in Pripyat's playground, a small handheld radiometer beeps at around 215 microengines, higher than normal. And a cuckoo calls in the background. It is an ironic juxtaposition of sounds as both allude to sudden eviction. Cuckoos pirate other birds' nests, ejecting the eggs and chicks, and the radiation forced the evacuation of all Pripyat's residents. In Ukrainian folklore, the cuckoo's call counts the years of one's life. Mickey Mouse was a Scorpio. The night was no light. Black. He came in. Light cracking the night. Stuck in the doorway. Of dark, deep, hard. My father. Lean in blue and white striped pajamas. Snatches my pajama bottoms off. Grabs me by my little skinny knees. And drives his dick in. I scream. No one hears except my sister, who becomes no one because she didn't hear. Years later, I become no one because it didn't happen. But It's night now, and it is happening. A train whose razor blades and wheels is riding through my arsehole. Iron hands saw at my knees. I'm gonna die. Blood and semen and shit gush from my cracked ass. My mother, glad not to be the one, comes in when it's over to wash me. She is glad. Glad. Satanic glad. She brings her hand up from between my legs and smears shit, semen and blood over my mouth. Now she knows what it's like to have a baby. She howls. Drugged night so black, you could paint with it. No moon, no stars, no God. The night stick smashes my spinal cord, my legs, bleeding bandages of light fall off. Let me go, let me go. Don't tell me about God and good little girls. I want to live, I want to live. My cells crack open like glass. The bells are trolling me. My name disintegrates in the night. God's a lie. This can't be true. Mickey Mouse. Mother is house. We have a nice house, California ranch style. Brother is the nail. We drive through your heart. Do it to her, brother. Mickey Mouse, see. Mouse is in the house. A definition of style. Our final piece of testimony from science is a brief statement about style by the atomic physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer. The balances and compromises suggested here are a clear consequence from a number of propositions about science and ordinary experience that have emerged from the five writers represented so far, that the sense data of our actual experience are given to us in high disorder. A fact that we disguise by the man-made rigor and neatness of language, that our neat language has lately become increasingly inadequate to express recent observations of nature, that a verbal system complete unto itself is doomed, that incongruity, flux, change are facts of life, that a necessary emphasis on the observer's own operation in science means an emphasis on the first person singular, and the modest awareness of the self as a limited, yet powerful, humble, yet the only source of wisdom there is. Oppenheimer has been director of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton since 1947. This paragraph is from a speech he delivered in 1948 called The Open Mind, later included in a volume of the same title. The problem of doing justice to the implicit, the imponderable and the unknown is of course not unique to politics. It is always with us in science. It is with us in the most trivial of personal affairs, and it is one of the great problems of writing and of all forms of art. The means by which it is solved is sometimes called style. It is style which complements affirmation with limitation and with humility. It is style which makes it possible to act effectively, but not absolutely. It is style which, in the domain of foreign policy, enables us to find the harmony between the pursuit of ends essential to us and the regard for the views, the sensibilities, the aspirations of those to whom the problem may appear in another light. It is style which is the deference that action pays to uncertainty. It is above all style through which power defers to reason.
Ignoring. Who rides so late through the night and wind? Who rides so late through night and wind? It is the father of this child. He has the boy where it's on. It is the father of this child. He has the boy where it's on. He holds him safely.
Thank you.
possible things. While the possible thing of sound is an alternative state of affairs that might not convince everybody, that might not be taken into account, that might be deliberately marginalized, it nevertheless demonstrates a possibility, or possibilities even, how things might be if only we listened. It will for many remain a lesser or a less noticed influence on reality. But there is a momentum of conviction in its coherence and truthfulness strong enough to consider the if that and come to a sonic then what of possibility. Beyond that then what of the possible thing of sound, the inaudible means no such conviction and cannot make itself heard. Actual listening, listening that obeys the rules of the actual world, cannot hear it. A possible impossible is, to use Daniel Nolan's words, badly behaved. It does not follow the logic of non-contradiction rules of the actual world and does not produce coherence with it because it has a property contrary to its essence. But what is the property of the inaudible and how can we make it sound the essence of actuality? If the inaudible contradicts the essence of the actual world, then it is not because what is inaudible is contradictory, but because the notion of a singular actuality depends on prescriptive references and a priori knowledge, and the inaudible is what we do not yet know about and thus cannot describe. However, it is intrinsically knowable, and in its possible impossibilities it can expand what that knowledge is and what references it might produce. The sonic possible and the sonic possible impossible, the audible and the inaudible, do not contradict but extend the logic of the actual world and challenge the scope of its language. The possible thing of sound makes apparent the plurality of the object as things thinging. It brings to attention their process and materiality, and makes them graspable as sensorial things that do not obey description, but trigger their own name. The inaudible augments these insights and deepens them. It has the permission to be further away from actuality, beyond the limits of the knowable and the thinkable, and so doesn't have to start with the restrictions of the actually known. And neither does it have to be limited to the imagination of the possible, but can generate the as yet unknown and unimagined from all that might sound but remains unheard, ultimately influencing the notion of the known and the imagined, discreetly expanding the idea of actuality through the incoherence of the impossible. The audible as a sonic possible makes apparent the limitations of the notion of actuality, revealing what it hides in its opaque clarity. And the inaudible, as a sonic possible impossible, makes apparent that there are things we do not know yet, but which are already here. The possible thing of sound and the possible impossible thing of sound both have an extension of quality. They extend to the actual object, the work, and the world, and make the inconceivable conceivable as part of the future actual work and actual world, and also remind us how to live in it. With the possible impossible thing of sound, to quote Nolan again, we allow ourselves to talk of what cannot be in a way which allows us to non-trivially make claims about how things would be if various impossibilities were to be the case. These impossibilities are aesthetic as well as political, facilitating the discussion of exclusion, exclusion of work, exclusion of people, and exclusion of ideas and values.
Thank you.
songbird from the Hawaiian island of Kauai. After many years of persistent habitat destruction and pressure from invasive species, the once thriving population had shrunk to just a single pair. In 1982, the female was lost when the island was ravaged during Hurricane Ida, leaving behind her male partner. It is his solitary voice that can be heard in this poignant recording made by John Sincock in 1983, an archive at the British Library. Singing from an old nest site of theirs, our lone oh, is calling for his mate, who would never respond. His song was heard for the last time in 1984, and the last sighting was in 1987. Finally, in 2000, the species was declared extinct. The birdsong performs a biophonic rhythm that once sounded the sentiment of attraction of courtship to a female oh, and now in the absence of the singer and the listener, is the mute sign of extinction. The loss of this sound carries its own politics and warning, and another politics emerges from the fact that it remained inaccessible to us, humans. The song sounds a rhythm for a different continuity that escapes our language and grammar and reminds us that while all rhythms and sounds are political, there are other political subjectivities, positions, and dispositions which also produce and perform rhythms and sounds. This brings to consciousness the precariousness of our own hearing and understanding of the world and of work and of ourselves. And even as we manage to listen to what sounds open to the opening of the world, it's not certainty, but doubt and process that we need to hear not only actual and possible sounds, but also those that have become impossible, that do not sound anymore, or those that are as yet impossible, that are, for ideological, aesthetic, or cultural reasons, not yet audible to us, whose meter is too far offbeat for us to hear, whose sound is inaccessible to our ears, and whose meaning and warning too alien for us to grasp, but nevertheless it sounds. Inspired by this story of the I want to promote a sensibility towards inaudible sounds that activate unrecognizable sentiments so that we do not lock what seems impossible out of language as listening, but understand the inaudible, the impossible, out of language as a rhythmic continuity of what seems possible now, an inaudible reminder of what used to sound and a warning of what might sound and what it might mean. March 16. It was 6 o'clock, an hour before sunrise, when I stopped to watch a barn owl. It wavered up to the road, whitening and hardening out of the grey half-light, drifted across and softly down towards the river. There was a heavy breath of silence in the dew-damp fields. A second owl rose from the grass verge and passed close. Its round white face looked slowly back, the big lolling head turned in wonderment. The dark prune-like eyes shone through the sad fool's mask of feathers. Then the long white wings came up and gathered the bird away into the fir woods, where night remained. On the estuary of the day was cold and clear. I saw the tide rise and turn and watched waters feeding and at rest while ducks slept and the sun moved west above the elm-crowned islands. An hour before sunset, I lay on the stone slope of the seawall, facing the golden red fire of the delighting sun. The tide dwindled on the mud, the cold air sharpened, it began to smell of the coming night. With a roar of wings like a cliff collapsing into the sea, every bird on the shore rose, leaving it bright beneath wind-clouded sky, which and flew overhead, sweeping up from the marsh behind the wall. There was a loud smacking sound like a plank hitting mud, a splash of falling excrement, and the harsh whistling of wings. The steeply climbing wichin fan apart. One fell back onto the marsh, huddled and slack, its narrow head hanging golden crested from the drooping, shaking neck. It looked unreal, as though it should have split sawdust, not dripped blood. It lay where it fell, crumpled and spoiled. The peregrine did not return to its kill while I was near. I had not seen it at all. It killed in the air above me, and I still could not see it, so fast and sudden was its stoop. At dusk I saw a barn owl again, hunting between road and river. For 20 minutes it quartered the meadow, moving across in long straight lines. 6 feet above the grass it flew, with fast, even wing beats. The steady pulse of its wings was curiously smooth. Dusk deepened. The owl grew bigger and whiter. The rising moon turned from deep orange to yellow as it drifted clear of the trees. The owl rested on a gatepost, and I could see the bland, meditative mask of its face looking at me from the grey of the field. The curved hook of its beak protruded from the heart-shaped disc of the mask like a single claw. The dark eyes were rimmed with wine. It flew overhead, and in the first coldness of the spring night, suddenly called. A hoarse, bellowing shriek drew out to a sharp edge and bristled away to silence. But not the silence that was there before. Gloria in excelsis mihi. At the height of the heavens, the angels whose voice I hear glorify me. I am beneath the sun, a wandering ant, small and black, a rolling stone. Reaches me, crushes me, dead in the sky. The sun blazes furiously, it blinds. I cry out, it will not dare, it dares. Who am I? Not me, no, but the desert, the night, the immensity. Which am I? What are? Desert immensity, night animal, soon irrevocable nothingness. And without having known anything, death, answer, sponge streaming with solar dreams. Enter me, so that I no longer know, but these tears. Star, which I am, O death, thunderous star, mad bell of my death. I put on the headphones and listened to a disaster warning to sing it for you. I read from Trista Wolff's Cassandra about pre-war. I played a voice text. I read from Albert Camus the play, and I played a second voice text. I played the feedback piece by Graham Gassin. Then I read Francis Bison. The tone of our times, sonic monotony. That was followed by Mark Ford, soft, sift, when I heard. I played Peter Cusack's music room, kindergarten, from sounds from dangerous places, with recordings in Chernobyl. And I read Kindergarten Footsteps, from the publication that goes with the CD. I played Peter Cusack's Kindergarten Radio Meeting, also from Sounds from Dangerous Places, and read over it the text of Cuckoo and the Radio Meter. I recited Sapphire, American Dreams, Mickey Mouse as a Scorpio, and played another voice text. That was followed by J. Robert Oppenheimer from The Limits of Language about style. And I read another voice text. I then played a piece, Irking, by myself, and read a further voice text. I played from Mertzberg's album 1930, the track München, and read from my own books on Impossible Worlds, Hearing the Continuum of Sound. I played the song of the last Kauai O-O-A-A, and read a text about him that was given to me by Cheryl Tipp, the British Library Wildlife Sound Curator, that I had added a commentary to. I read a further voice text, followed by J.A. Baker, The Peregrine. I then recited George Bataille's Inner Experiences, Gloria in Excelsis Me. Played another voice text, and now I'm playing Lawrence English, Intercepted Communication, and read the credits of everything I've read to you, I will.